Okay, time for comments on Crooked Cucumber Chapter 4. I'll be throwing in comments in the comments, you know, when I go over it and look things up and stuff. And you might notice some rain in the background happening at certain points of that. Pitter patter on the roof. So, one thing about Chapter 4 here is I recorded it with the fan on. I don't have the fan on now, but, you know, I was reading a whole chapter, and it was just, there's a ceiling fan above me. I have the other fans off. I have the doors closed, but I can hear it back there. It sounds, it's very low, and probably you won't notice it. It sounded to me a little, I kept hearing something like somebody smacking their lips a little bit. And I realized after a while, oh, that's the fan going around. Oh, well. And I tried to take it out with noise reduction, but I don't, and it took it down a little. All right. So anyway, not a tremendous amount here in comments, although I'll probably drag it out. So the first thing I noticed is that the book itself has a misspelling. And I thought, oh, it must just be in my file here. And then I went and looked. The whole book's on Cuke.com. I went and looked at that chapter on Cuke.com. Ah, same misspelling. And then I opened up the book. Same misspelling. Another errata we hadn't discovered. And that is the spelling, and it's Japanese. Why didn't the Japanese translators tell me? Well, they don't have to worry about it. They don't use letters, and they know it's not really hidden. It's Daihonzan is the correct spelling. Daihonzan. That's the name of this chapter is Great Root Mountain Temples. Something like that. Nope. Great Root Monasteries. Zan, which in combination is Zan, it's San, Yama, mountain. And it's used for temples or monasteries in the name. That's Dai is great, Hon is root, and Zan is mountain. Except in the book, it's spelled Daihonzan. Uh-oh. So, anyway, I would really like to get a new edition of Crooked Cucumber out, and I'm going to try to get hold of Broadway or Michael Katz says it's Crown. Probably I'll get hold of Crown. God, they all, you know, it's Penguin, Random House, and I think, I wonder if Bertelsmann in Germany still owns them. But, and then Crown, they were all different, and they all just joined together. Not good. The elimination of the weakening, the thinning out of small publishers. But, you know, there's a lot of people like me that, I have a little publishing company, you know, Cuke Press. Hey, you can order a brief history of Tassajara. From Native American sweat lounges to pioneering Zen monastery. Order it now. Published by Cuke Press. All right. So the next thing. Oh, I wanted to mention something about seniority. It said, so Shunyu's a Daihachi now, right? And it said he will have the same Daihachi birth date as the monks that are with him. And that's, you know, establishes the seniority there. That's very, very important, especially in Japanese society, but also in Buddhism. I think my friend Moneya, who's a Theravada monk from good Lord, where's he from? Ohio or something. We're going to have him on reading a poem in a while. And I published a book of his poetry on Cuke Press, Manea Chronicles. Anyway, he says that the only hierarchy in Buddha's order was seniority. You know, there weren't any positions other than that. Well, I said, well, what about when you became an arhat or something? Well, I don't know how that worked out. But, so that's important there at Aheiji. After Aheiji, I don't know. It's sort of like college seniority, I think. But one thing in Japan, it's a big deal. The senior is the senpai, and the junior is the kohai. And I've heard a lot of hazing stories, very serious hazing stories. And the senpai-kohai thing follows you all your life there in your relationship to who you were with in that monastery or that university or whatever. I've had, you know, adults in their 50s introduce me to a friend of theirs saying it was their senpai. And I remember Richard Baker telling me, talking about looking down at a school and watching these kids and seeing the older kids, you know, harassing the younger kids. And this was going on all over, that with the boys, you know, probably more subtle with the girls. Oh, one thing you didn't hear when I read and does not exist anymore in my version is the line which reads now, at Aheiji, you had to walk and work efficiently and silently. Now, in the book, I originally wrote initially wrote, you had to walk and work slowly. That's wrong. You know, I was just brainwashed with American Zen, where there's this whole idea of Zen slow. And Thich Nhat Hanh, like you will hear Ed Brown and I talk about this in the podcast that's coming up with chat with Ed Brown. Now, they do something slowly. I'm not saying they don't do something slowly and mindfully and all that. But my experience, like cleaning a temple in Japan, is that you do it as fast as you can. Now, maybe when they walk down the hall, they don't go, I don't know. There's a saying in Japan that people walk so fast there. But I think the saying was something like, people in Tokyo walk so fast. Or I might have just been Japanese walk so fast because they're running from tsunami and volcanoes. Anyway, the whole thing saying slowly was just some idea that was stuck in my head that shouldn't have been there then. I knew better at that time. So, it comes at another place too. It says, then with hands clasped at the solar plexus, they walked off to morning service and the repetition of sutras in magnificent ancient rooms. I used to have, they walked slowly, in that one too. And I took it out. You know, I don't know when they walk slow and when they walk fast at AAG. I shouldn't have said it. All right. Now, so then we get to Kitano, who was this teacher there. He just calls him Kitano. I've got his whole name here. Kitano Gimpo. Oh, you know, I should be saying the family name first and given name or the Buddhist name second. It's like official now in Japan. But I am not doing it because the book didn't do that. At some point I should switch. It said Kitano had been, now he was the abbot of Aheiji, right? And then Suzuki talked about being so old he looked like he was sick and falling down, ready to die every time he bowed, but he'd get up and Suzuki was just so impressed with him. He led a service or just watching him bow, just mesmerized him. And I, you know, I can appreciate that. I've had that experience with some old people. There was a guy, at, I used to play tennis. I played tennis a lot when I was a kid. It was great because I got to skip PE, physical education, in the 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th grades because I was on the tennis team and the coaches didn't know heck about it. So I went to the country club. Every day I got out early from school and I had a car. I was driving to school. My sister and I had a car starting when I was in the 8th grade. And I had a beginner's license then, and I can remember driving to school in that car, little four-door 57 Chevy, in the 9th grade. I can remember driving to school in it. Isn't that amazing? I was a legal driver at 14. Oh, God. I could tell you a story about that, man. I might as well. Hey, I was in New York with a family reunion and in Rochester. And my mother's family is German, German-American. And her big sister, Brunhilde, who we call Bruni. Mother's Adele, and their last name's Reich, but we said Rich. Bruni, mother married a regular old southern mongrel like me. And just another southern white guy, right? And they all have sort of mixed blood from, you know, Europe and this and that. There's usually some black and Indian blood and stuff. None of that showed up in my sister, though. She had like 99.98% European. I was up there in New York, and Uncle Carl Plager, very Germanic American uncle, and a disciplinarian. We kids were there, and I was like, I don't know, 14, 15, I don't remember. And we all wanted to go to the lake and take a boat out and go water skiing, but there wasn't any adult to drive us. And I said, well, Mother Susan and I had driven up there. I don't know if Susan had driven with us, but that didn't matter. Anyway, so we had a car. I said, I can drive. And the kids went, oh, yeah, great. And Uncle Carl went, you cannot drive. Now, he was very, very adamant. And I said, you know, if he just said, no, I don't care if you're legal, you can't drive on one lane, I'd understand that. I'd especially understand it now. But he didn't say that. He said, you can't drive, it's not legal for you to drive. And you know, I didn't come from a family with heavy authoritarianism. And my father had died when I was 11. Eliminated a certain amount of authority. So I argued with him respectfully, and I said, no, I can drive. And he said, you cannot drive here. The legal driving age here is, I guess, 18. I said, all right, Uncle Carl, I will call the police. And if the police say it is legal for me to drive, can I drive everybody to the lake? He said, well, of course, but it's not legal. So I called them, and you know what I said? I said, hi, do you honor California? No, I'm not from California. Hi, do you honor Texas driver's licenses? And I said, Carl, they honor Texas driver's licenses. He said, yes, but you're underage. He said, let me talk to them. So I got to drive them. Anyway, So, pardon me. So, back to what on earth was I telling you about driving to junior high school for? I have no idea. I'll have to go back and listen to hear how I got into that tangent. All right. So anyway, so he was really into Kitano. Oh, I know. They're respecting older people. So at the country club, where I went every day after school and on weekends, there was a man who was like 92 years old who would play tennis with us. And I just loved him. And when he talked, when he came up, I just felt good. And when he talked, I was mesmerized. There was something about his vibes that, I mean, I didn't know what it was, but I still remember it. They were wonderful. And he could still play tennis. I want to play tennis, but my internist, he's not my internist, my digestive doctor, here, that's the way they classify it, says, you know, with my hernia, he didn't want me doing that. He said it's too worried. He didn't want me to do rough things like that. So that's too bad. But I might start another time, but anyway. So Kitano, it says, was at some point, I said he was the, well, there was a whole mix-up. I had said in chapter 3 that Isobe founded the Zenshuji in Los Angeles. Now, this is a detail that nobody will care about but me and a few hardcore Zenny, Soto Zen, pardon me, ow, gotta uncross my legs here, Soto Zen people in California or something. But there was this whole thing in the translation about, I said, Kitano, it was like, who was the abbot of Zenshuji in Los Angeles? I said, the founder. I said Isobe was in chapter 3. I had that. But then in the translators, Akiba, who had been the bishop of Soto Zen in North America, you know, and has a little Zendo in Oakland, and married Yoshi from Yoshi's nightclub, and is pretty much retired there. He said, no, Kitano was the founder, and sent something that had founder, Kitano Gimpo. But then, so, all right, I was going to change it all and everything. But then I look on the Zenshuji website, and they have the founder is Isobe in 1922 in his apartment. So I think maybe what happened, and, you know, maybe I'll get to the bottom of this, is that Isobe started the ball rolling by having, and I think he was calling it Zenshuji in his apartment. And Zenshuji means Zen sect temple or Zen school temple. And you can see in 1922, where there was, I would imagine, no other Zen temple in America, he wouldn't have to say Soto Zen or this or that. He gave it a very general name, Zen sect temple. And then maybe when the temple, an official temple in LA was founded, you know, in its own building, maybe at that point Kitano was the first priest there, the head priest there. As a result of that, we keep changing them back and forth. So, you know, what I've done is I've just called them there. You know, like they were one of the founders or one of the early priests. I just say stuff like that. Another problem with using superlatives. If you don't use superlatives, then it's life is easier. So he tells a smoking story about Kitano, and I love that story about him hiking up on top of the Hakone Pass and sitting there and looking at the village below. And it said it was damp weather, and he loved smoke and damp weather, you know, the humidity. Maybe there was a mist. And he looked at it and he thought, oh, such a great cigarette. And he thought, ah, perfect time for it to be my last cigarette. That's pretty good back then, because there was not much of an idea that smoking wasn't good for you. Smoking in Japan was promoted by the government, and then later in China, big money in it. And I don't know if they're doing that in China now, but it was like, you know, in Japan, in China, it's like the government's making money off it, right? In Japan, the national tobacco whatever thing was like a government thing. It was like, I don't think they owned the businesses, but old people were saying, you know, it's the government wouldn't do that if it was bad for you, because they really trusted the government. Now, a lot of them after World War II dropped that. I've sure talked to a lot of old people in Japan. They'd all be gone now, just telling me they hated the government, they hated the emperor, that their children died, and, you know, they lost their sons, and their daughter died in a bombing raid. Oh, man. So a lot of them didn't trust the government. But in general, the society, it's that trusts and respects the government. So, that's turned around now. When I lived there, man, it was just a lot of people. A lot of the men smoked. A lot of the men smoked. My neighbor, oh, my God, older guy, just had to listen to him cough all the time. Terrible. So, you know what it said about he loved smoke in damp weather? Well, I used to smoke, and that is so true. And one thing that made it hard to quit was living on the coast, living in, you know, in Muir Beach, where Green Gulch is. And I had a cabin down at Muir Beach, too, and living in Bolinas. I lived in Bolinas for years, and I'd always have a place in the city or Green Gulch, too, or down at the beach, Muir Beach. I had a little cabin at Yvonne Rand's, and cigarettes are so much better in humidity. And then I'd like to go to the desert. I could not stand cigarettes in Death Valley or in a desert. They're dry and harsh. There's nothing you could do. I mean, what would you do? You know, have a spray bottle of water or something and create a mist around you and dampen the cigarettes. Anyway, I really think, I might be wrong about this. This is just my observation. I think nicotine is the greatest drug of all time. The only thing is it's not good for you. You can't say it's the most. It's super addictive. I mean, it's got worse addiction statistics than anything. But one reason for that might be that it doesn't kill you immediately, like ODing on bad heroin or something. You know, it doesn't wreck your life. It acts in slow motion, until recently wasn't socially disapproved of. Man, very, very hard to quit. Extremely hard to quit. I really admired people who quit. God, who was it? Was it Mark or Greg said at Tassajara once? I'll never forget it. He said, whenever I feel depressed, I just say to myself, you quit smoking, and then I feel good. But why do I say that nicotine is the greatest drug? It is so good for concentrating. And it doesn't bring you down. Now, it doesn't bring you down in any way. It is sort of a mild stimulant, you can focus on things really well, and you can do things really well on it. And it, it, the, it's not a drug that fools you, I don't think. And just look at the number of writers and musicians and creative people that have been chain smokers. Gregory Bateson figured that, and you know, some people think he's one of the greatest minds of the 20th century. And very close with Michael Katz. He lived with Michael Katz. Michael brought him to Zen Center. And he lived and died his last years at Zen Center. Anyway, he calculated that the number of cigarettes he'd smoked, he could stack it, go to the moon and back or something like that. Michael told me that. It's hard to quit. I can remember times working where I would just smoke one cigarette after another. And it just, I just get in this zone. It was just so good. But then it'd make you feel bad and you'd be coughing and stuff, you know. And you can't get around the bad effects. You can make it less bad by, you know, vaping and taking Nicorettes. But it's all bad for you. It's evil. You know what it does? It takes over your command center. So the same place that I'm going to quit, this will be my last cigarette, you know, and you're absolutely positive. Same place that comes from then says, well, I don't know, maybe you have one more. I got an email from, oh, it's about, I don't know, about 10 years ago, I got an email. Somebody, they sent it out to their whole list. They said, you know, I've been smoking for 20 years and I've got to quit. And I'm absolutely determined to quit. And I'm writing all of you to support me. And it was one of these emails where you can see all the CCs or the maybe put everybody in the to list. And I wrote back and I said, oh, I know he said he had quit and he wanted the support. And I wrote back and I said, yeah, that's really great. I think you can have one more, though. It won't hurt anything if you have one more. And he wrote back with, thank you, thank you. I was taking it too seriously. Yeah, you got to do it. It's important. I'll tell the story of quitting things at some point. Okay, so moving on to the next thing in this very quick, brief comments on the chapter. Okay, here's the thing. Now, this is a real Zen thing, and it's to do with Zen Center. It says, in morning service, they would chant the names, you know, at the end of the service, well, toward the end of the service, they would chant the names of all the ancestors. From, you start off with the seven Buddhas, Shakyamuni Buddha, and then the Mahayana lineage with Maya Kashyapa, which is not at all the Theravadan lineage, you know. And, you know, it's well known that the lineage is full of holes and they fill things in and stuff. But it's the spirit that is passed on. It's not all historically accurate. No religious stuff is historically accurate. That's not the point. Doesn't matter. Hang on there, boy. That's an absolute. I can't say that. Some stuff is historically accurate. But I was thinking about the myths and stories around religions, the spiritual teaching. I consider all spiritual teaching to be myth or mythic, not to be taken literally. It's hinting at something wonderful. So we shouldn't bring it down to earth, or like Pseudo-Dionysius wrote, the worst is describing the highest in terms of the lowest. Now, he had two main warnings that, you know, he's the early Syrian monk, like, you know, 3rd, 4th, 5th century. He had two main warnings about understanding of spiritual teachings. He said in a letter to his brother Timothy that it's hopeless to try to communicate with those who can only see things in terms of individual being. And then what I said before, that even worse is those who speak of the highest in terms of the lowest. And that's literalism. Basically, he said you got to drop it all to keep ascending. So they chant the ancestors down to Keizan Jokin. And Keizan Jokin is like, I don't know, five teachers after Dogen or something. I can't remember. The two great teachers historically in Soto Zen are Dogen Zenji, Dogen, the founder, who didn't want to found a sect. And he just wanted to teach that way, right? And Keizan. And why Keizan, and I think I put in there, yeah, I did, that Dogen is considered the father and Keizan the mother. Who told me that? I think Kobun Jino told me that. And Keizan's the one that popularized it. Soto Zen is, it's got a lot of followers in Japan. Now, they don't necessarily know why they're following it, just what their parents did. It has to do with where, you know, with memorial services and stuff like that. I've asked a lot of people, you know, they'd say, well, I'm a Buddhist, but I'm not a very good Buddhist. Why do you say that? Well, I haven't offered incense to my ancestors recently. I'd say, you know, run into that all the time. And then I'd say, well, what sect are you? Nanshu. And say, I don't know. Really, I'd hear that. Right? They go, or they might know. They'd say, well, it's this temple over here. And I go, oh, that's Tendai, or that's Shingon, or that's Rinzai, or that's Soto Zen, or something. And, Keizan popularized it. And he appealed to the peasants, to the poor, to the farmers, and he brought it. I really can't tell you. I can't give you in a nutshell Keizan's teaching, but that's what he's known for, and he is revered. So Keizan founded Sojiji, the other temple where Suzuki went, and his full Buddhist name that we chant is Keizan Jokin. So you can see why he was so popular, because everyone likes someone with a good sense of humor. Keizan Jokin. Now, then it says, but I didn't get to my Zen Center point on this. Oh, the whole thing, all right. So, and they chant the names of the ancestors down to Keizan, right? And then they go to their rooms. It says Kishizawa went to his room, right? But they all do. Oop, pardon me. They all do. Ryogen Yoshimura told me that. He was one of the priests who helped us at Tassajara. Wonderful man. May he rest in peace. Of course, the young monks didn't have rooms. They slept in the zendo, which they call a sodo, or monk's hall. So I don't know what they did or where or if they did it. But Yoshimura told me after the morning service, monks do that. And he said he'd go to his room and chant the rest of the lineage down to his teacher. They go to their rooms and they chant. Or at least they should. We don't know because we can't see them. They chant the names. We know Kishizawa did because Suzuki saw him doing it. They chant the names of the ancestors from Keizan to their own teachers. So Kishizawa would do it to Nishiari Bokusan. Now at Tassajara, at Zen Center, I remembered at Tassajara, and because I love going there in the summers. That's one of the main things I miss about America, is going to Tassajara in the summers. I love it there. I do dishes. I'd still love to do dishes there. And I go for 10 days. Katrinka and I would go. Clay and I went many times. Kelly spent a lot of time, my older son, when he was growing up. It was an important experience for him. Kelly worked a lot. Clay worked a lot. Clay was a great worker. Clay would go to the zendo and services and everything. He likes to do what other people are doing. But anyway, the service there, They would chant in the Zendo all the way down to Shunryu Suzuki. Now, I think that's a mistake. They shouldn't do that. They should chant it to Keizan Joki, just like at Eiheiji. Why? Because the reason they do it to Keizan Joki is that it's for every lineage in Soto Zen, for monks to come from different lineages in Soto Zen, and then they all go back to Keizan Joki. But they don't, you know, that like at Tazara, they're, it should be open to people from other lineages. And even if that doesn't really apply so much in America, I think it would be the right thing to do. And we give people another little ceremony to do in their rooms. And people really like ceremonies. Keep adding them. That's just some point I wanted to make. I have never checked that with any, I might have mentioned it, but I've never really checked it with, you know, like, I consider the ultimate authority in America to check with something like that would be Shohaku Okamura in Indiana, who I have great respect for. You'll hear a little more about him on Saturday the 30th when Taigen Dan Layton's chat goes up. He and Taigen have worked together on translations. So, Sesshin, now it says, literally a mind gathering. Why did I say literally a mind gathering? Because that's what I'd been told. Did I check up on it? Even though I had studied tons of Japanese and had studied the characters and everything? No, I just repeated what I'd been told without thinking about it. That's what Richard Baker said. I think maybe that's what Suzuki told him. I don't know. It comes from somewhere back there. But if you look at what it means touching the mind. Sesshin, literally, a mind gathering? No. To contact or touch the mind. Now, here's another thing. So anyway, I should change that, or I should find out why we said mind gathering. And it's probably too late to find it out. I mean, it's nice. You can sort of get, you know, if you're touching it. Touching, you get an idea like that one finger. One finger touching the mind. And gathering is like both hands. So I started thinking about all this after this was all recorded. And I thought, wait, I probably did look into it back then and decided mind gathering was right. And Taigen Dan Layton did this scholarly check, and so he let it pass. And then I talked to him for 2 hours just last night, Wednesday night. And right after this, you're going to hear that I just heard Richard Baker's podcast last night. Well, that's another last night because I'm recording this later. So I talked to Taigen for 2 hours, Wednesday night. And he did use the word gathering in how he translated it. And he pointed out that there are all these layers of meanings and characters. And, you know, you can't, if you're working with classical stuff and Buddhist stuff, you can't necessarily rely on the dictionary definition. And I'm aware of that. And so you look at the different meanings, he said, and you figure out which one's appropriate for each particular use. So, anyway, I'm very happy I can leave mind gathering alone. Good. Incidentally, I'll be joining Taigen and his students on a Zoom discussion, and that'll be fun. It will be my second Zoom experience. I just listened last night to a Richard Baker lecture coming from Crestone on Zoom, my first Zoom experience. And the video wasn't working. And all I knew about the video is that everybody's there with, you know, you can see them. I think you don't, you can undo where they can't see you, right? You can sort of mute the visual. And as soon as I realized there was no video, I went, great, I'll make dinner while I'm listening to this. And because if I'd have been on video with everybody else, I would have had to sit up straight and properly listen. So I made dinner, ate it, and, pardon me, you see I'm gesturing and hitting the mic, and cleaned it up during the lecture. And then at the very end, the German group came on. It went to the screen. All of a sudden, there was video, and it was Johanneshof, Baker's retreat in the Black Forest, where I've gone, and I love it there, and I love the people there. So cool. I'm so comfortable there. I'm comfortable at Crestone, too. They're very nice to me, and it's really nice. So anyway, I saw all these people I knew, and I couldn't remember everybody's name, but I could find out real quick. You know, one thing I do is ask Katrinka. She remembers names much better than me. But it was just so neat seeing them. So, you know, on the one hand, I don't like FaceTime. I have used FaceTime some when the other person wants, but basically, we don't do it inside our family. We use Marco Polo. Marco Polo is really good, but you're not on at the same time. And Marco Polo, you can switch it to show what's in front of you, not just looking at you. It's really good. It's a video walkie-talkie. Kelly got me into it, and we all use it now in family. It's really good. It increases the quality of communication because you're not there at the same time and not going, just dragging the conversation, going out, yeah, well, well, okay, it's been real good. Oh, yeah, da, da. You know, it's just, when you want to hear what they have to say, you listen to it, and they say what they had to say and show you what they wanted to show you. And then when it's right time for you, you tell them what you want to say and send something back or not. And it's so much more efficient. And what I've found is it increases communication while decreasing the amount of time and making it more efficient. So anyway, that's my ad for Marco Polo. It's an unpaid advertisement. Sashin, I haven't gotten to the second part of what I wanted to say about it, is they call it, you see, frequently see it translated or described as a mind-heart gathering, or to touch the mind-heart, or to touch the heart-mind. Now, that character, the Chinese character, is heart. It does mean heart in the sense, not in the sense of your physical heart, even though the character is heart. Your actual physical heart in Japanese, Shinzo. And the Shin in Shinzo is heart, the same one. When Suzuki Roshi said big mind, he didn't say big heart mind. The word mind is constantly used by Buddha. It's used in the sort of Christianity I grew up in, which is what I call mind only. Mind, we use the word mind instead of God. And Buddha used the word mind, really, instead of Buddha a lot, instead of Buddha mind. And Bodhidharma said, somebody asked him, what is mind? He says, what is mind? Mind is that which is asking what is mind. I think, listen, I'm remembering way back. You know, when you say shin, like seshin, that's in combination, they use the like Japanized Chinese, that's the Shin. But if they're using it by itself, they use the Japanese word kokoro. So then I go, all right, let's see. I mean, kokoro, I use it for mind and heart. They definitely use it for heart, like feeling heart. So I look it up. It says heart, mind, mentality, emotions, feelings. All right, so why don't we say seshin means touching heart, mind, mentality, emotions, feelings. No, I think we should pick one and say mind. I think it's better. And keep in mind that it's the character's heart. Now listen, here in Bali and in Indonesia, the word for heart, physical heart, is jantung. But the word for emotional heart is hati. And you know what hati means? It means liver. I mean, that's the word. If you go to the doctor and say you think you got a problem with your liver, you say hati. But if you're telling someone to be careful, you say hati, hati. And if, anyway, hati is used like for emotional heart. And baik hati, baik is good, baik hati, good heart. It's a nice thing to say about somebody that they have a good liver. We're talking about the mind, like big mind. So then I look up the Pali and Sanskrit. So let me read you what I got there. Citta, Pali and Sanskrit, C-I-T-T-A-C-C-H, like in Indonesian, C is C-H. Citta, Pali and Sanskrit, is one of three overlapping terms used in the Nikaya to refer to the mind, the others being manas and vijnana. Each is sometimes used in the generic and non-technical sense of mind in general, and the three are sometimes used in sequence to refer to one's mental processes as a whole. Their primary uses are, however, distinct. The Pali English Dictionary translates citta as heart or mind, emphasizing it as more the emotive side of the mind as opposed to manas as the intellect or the sense of what grasps mental objects. Citta is the object of meditation in the third part of Satipatthana, also called the four foundations of mindfulness. Citta primarily represents one's mindset or state of mind, blah, blah, blah. And anyway, all right, well, I don't want to get down to the other one. Regarding volitions, there is similarity between vijnana and citta. They are both associated with the qualitative conditions of a human being. Vijnana provides awareness and continuity by which one knows one's moral condition, and citta is an abstraction representing that condition. And then there's Hridaya, and it's Sanskrit. The only place where I know it used is in the name of the Heart Sutra, the Prajnaparamita Hridaya Sutra. We don't say the Mind Sutra, we say Heart Sutra. And Hridaya also means heart or mind, and it means the spiritual heart. In this instance, I always thought of it meaning the core, the nugget of the Prajnaparamita Sutra, because the massive Prajnaparamita is multiple volumes, and then there's various reduced versions, and that's the heart of it. So sometimes we say heart, and sometimes we say mind. And it's good to know both are conveyed, but I think it's best usually to choose one or the other. At one point, Kishizawa says to Shunyu, rather than clean two rooms, do one room well. Light one corner of the world. This, I'm just going to read you straight out of wherever I got this. This saying is from the founder. Oh, this is from Peter. This is from Peter Schneider. You know why he sent me this? Because I put out a book on vignettes about Shunyu Suzuki, to shine one corner of the world, teaching stories and anecdotes of Shunyu Suzuki. Oh, no, that's the Shambhala version of it. To shine one corner of the world, Moments with Shunyu Suzuki is what it was originally called when it was Broadway, and now it's Shambhala, as Zen is right here. So Peter did not want me to name it that. He says, that's not Suzuki, that's Tendai, that's Sacho. And I said, well, it's just something he said, and, you know, almost everything he said came from somewhere else, came from China or Dogen or something like that. I mean, we didn't realize the extent to which a lot of what he said wasn't original. He was very original and creative and spontaneous, but he was bringing us what he had learned, which was a substantial amount, and he comes from a tradition where they pass on wisdom from the past, so I thought it was all right. So here's what Peter wrote. This saying is from the founder of Tendai in Japan, 806. So that's before Dogen. Saicho, or Dengyo Daishi, and is very familiar to me because it was written on a sign for a Tendai high school in Sakamoto, that's where Peter lived there, near Kyoto, that I passed, Peter and Jane, that I passed whenever I went to teach Ichigo o Terasu. So in the Tendai sect of Japanese Buddhism, there is a phrase, I'm getting this from somewhere else. In the Tendai sect of Japanese Buddhism, there is a phrase, Ichigo o Terasu, to light a corner of the world, from which came the proverb, a person who lights up a single corner is truly a national treasure. And here's another quote about it. Under the auspices of Reverend Yamada, the Tendai sect, which has inherited Saicho's lamp of truth, has initiated a light up a corner of the world movement. This movement must not remain limited to the Tendai sect. All Buddhists must take part. 1989. So Yamada was the head of the Tendai sect, 1989. I think Tendai is the oldest sect of Buddhism in Japan, and it's very old. And its roots go back to China, of course. Okay, so anyway, you see they said it's not limited to the Tendai sect. All Buddhists must take part. So following Reverend Yamada's encouragement, I did that. So, Suzuki says, about when he's talking about Miss Ransom, this is the last time he saw her when she visited him at Rinso Inn when he was there from Meiji. He says, and she went back to China. Man, wow. That's just, think of, you know, in the 30s and 40s living in Japan and China, amazing. After she went back to Tientsin, she sent me a picture of the same Buddha who had caused trouble between us. She had enshrined the Buddha in the wall where there was an alcove, and she said she was offering incense every day. That's amazing, huh? She wasn't really a Buddhist, but she appreciated it. She was always a Quaker. And people at Zen Center would say, oh, she was Suzuki Roshi's first convert and stuff like that. Well, he didn't really convert people. He didn't care if they were Buddhists or not. And he appealed many Christians. I know students of his who were at Tassajara who are Christians today and still revere him, even born-again Christians. So I wanted to say something about this Buddha because Suzuki made such a point in talking to Miss Ransom about what Buddhism is, what Zen is. And he and Katagiri both tended to talk more about Buddhism than Zen. They'd say, well, it's not really Zen, it's just Buddhism. But, you know, every sect of Buddhism, every teacher says, Buddhism is blah, blah, blah. We Buddhists, so and so. And there's a lot of different approaches in there. I don't know what you can say Buddhists agree on. You know, Christianity is the same thing. Although Buddhists tend to get along better, except for, say, Nichiren Shoshu, the Soka Gakkai. Well, the Sukhogakai and Nichiren Shoshu split, and Sukhogakai was more the political arm. Not a bad political party either. Peace, love, dove, you know, there. And Sukhogakai really appealed to poor people. It was very big in America still, and big among minorities and poor. I respect it. It does come from pretty fanatic origins, and they did sort of tend to say all other Buddhists are going to hell and stuff. But, you know, I don't know if they're that way. Anyway, so Suzuki made a big point about talking to Miss Ransom about what Buddhism was, why he offered incense to the Buddha and this and that. And he didn't want to take the approach, well, it's just some wood, which I said in the book, which some Zen teachers do. Well, I'm more on the it's just a bunch of wood side of things. But I've spent plenty of time offering incense to Buddhas and doing stuff like that. And I don't mind because I know how to do it. I mean, you just do it. It's just something you do, showing respect. Mainly, I'm showing respect for other people because if other people aren't doing it, I don't do it. It's just not my trip. I did this interview with Earl Hartman, Blanche Hartman's son, one of her sons, at Tassara. And Earl is a Kyudo master who's lived years in Japan as a Japanese wife. He has his own Kyudo school. He's highly regarded. He knows Buddhism. He knows Japan. While at the same time, he's an Orthodox Jew with a rather strict view of things. And he's funny. He's great. He was going, I tell Mom, you're an idol worshiper. And she said, no, you don't understand. He said, yes, I do. I see you bowing to idols. Isn't that great? I'm not into holy places either. And I've been around a lot of holy places. And then people will say, oh, wasn't the feeling wonderful there? And to me, it's just another place. It is neat being in Bodh Gaya, you know, and all that. I really love something. It's a dangerous, very dangerous area. I get to talking about India. I tell you some experiences around Bodh Gaya. It's the poorest state in India. You'd want to get in to where Bodh Gaya is and stay around there. And you don't want to get out at night outside of town. It's dangerous. Anyway, you know, when it gets down to it, to me, it's just another place. Holy Mountains, I've been around Holy Mountains. I've been around Holy Land, where a vast number of people around it talk about the great feeling they can feel, the spiritual vibrations coming from it and all that. I'm not saying that isn't true. I believe in everything. I think that's all true. It's just not true for me. And I'm just not into that. To me, I carry my holy place with me. And holiness is everywhere. There's not a place that isn't the absolutely most holy thing ever, that ever was. But I know the other stuff's true. And I believe in crystals. I believe in everything. But it's just not my way. It's not my path. I've been around a lot of that stuff. I grew up around a certain amount of it. I grew up in the what I call the precursor to the New Age. So in a sense, I was sort of vaccinated. And whereas I believe in everything, I don't really believe strongly in anything. I mean, beliefs shouldn't be things that define you, to me. To me, that's fundamental in spiritual practice. I'd say that belief is, I said it when I was speaking to a group here, Buddhist group, they're at dinner retreat, and they asked me to say something. I mean, a lot of us could say something. And I said, belief is the enemy of spiritual practice. And the head teacher, I get along with quite well, he and said, well, he didn't really agree with that. I should have modified that. And I probably did at the time. And it was, I read one time a Tibetan Buddhist thing saying, belief is the first door. It's sort of like, I mean, you got to believe things to function, but it's sort of like belief is always relative. You can't believe in, what is believing? It's like holding on to something or something like that, right? So we need to do that all the time to function in this and that. And, you know, we hear about, you know, so we hear about practice or whatever, and we move toward it. Well, all right, so with the first door, you get in there. To me, to go through that next door, you got to give up that belief. You'll have another belief. It's like having clothes on. You go in there with certain clothes. You got to take a layer off to go to the next one. Then you got to take a layer off to go to the next one. Like that. That's sort of the way I see it. And so it's okay to have beliefs. I mean, I believe a lot of things, but they're not important. If they're not true, I don't care. And this whole thing about science or faith, what a pile of crap. That there is absolutely no possible conflict with science and real spirituality. It is impossible. I mean, science is observations about phenomena and, you know, measurements, things like that. And Dalai Lama would ask, what would he do if you know, science disagreed with his religion? He said, well, the religion would have to change then. But I would say impossible because... But yeah, because anything you believe that seems to have something to do with the phenomenal realm, it's just myth, and that's another level. Science doesn't reach into the myth level. Religion, people's so-called religion that is based on believing things in phenomena, like certain phenomenal stuff has to be true, that's just... That's like an anchor holding you to earth. All right, enough of that. But I want to say some more about the Buddha. So I never have a Buddha. Well, if somebody gives me a Buddha, I'll put it up, you know. And, you know, maybe I'll offer incense or something. I really wouldn't do it. It's like I say, it's something other people do. And I have... Katringa likes Buddhas, and so I like Buddhas too. And our landlord gave us a Buddha he grew up with. He's such a wonderful guy, so we had a little altar made for it. And our, at Kadek, she makes offerings to it. Every time she's here, she'll have flowers, so she goes out and makes offerings to it. You know, every home in Bali has a temple. Well, I don't know with Muslims what they do. I know when I was here in 92, I saw Muslims making the same offering that Hindus did, but those are really sort of animistic offerings to spirits. In fact, well, I call the Hinduism here Voodoo Hindu because, I mean, they talk about Vishnu and Krishna and, you know, Brahma and all that. But that's just sort of intellectual. That's up there. What they're really into, and they're really into the Mahabharata and the Bhagavad Gita, mainly the Mahabharata. All their ceremonies and all their dances are tied into the Mahabharata. I've got a big painting of the Mahabharata on cloth out here that it's our landlord's that he put up here. It's beautiful. It's very intricate and very large. And it's Mahabharata. And, you know, I don't know what's spiritual about that. It's just a story. the Upanishads is where the fundamental teaching of Hinduism is that I can relate to, and I do relate to it. All right, so anyway. So I wanted to quote a little Suzuki here. So even though he was like totally into the Buddha and offering incense and all that, here's something straight out of a talk of his. In our practice, we have no special object of worship. If so, our practice is something different from the usual practice. When we practice Zazen, we limit our activity. Our practice in the smallest extent, just to keep right posture and to be concentrated on sitting. This is how we express the universal nature or true nature. Then you become you, yourself, become Buddha. You express Buddha nature or true nature or universal nature. So instead of having some object of worship, we limit. We concentrate our activity on some activity which we tackle. So when you bow, you should just bow. When you sit, you have to sit. When you eat, you just eat. If you do so, the universal nature is there. So another time he said, instead of having some particular object of worship, we just focus or pay attention to what's at hand, you know. I don't remember how he said it, but that's the way, I got that. I dig that. So that's my Buddha. Now let's look at the word worship, because it's one of these words that, you know, it comes out of our Judeo-Christian tradition that makes people sort of uncomfortable. You go, worship, yucky. But what does worship mean? I mean, what can it mean? What can it mean to worship God? It means what's worthy. That's where the word comes from. What's worthy? What's worth your time? What's worth your attention? And what's worth your attention is God, is your absolute nature. All right, moving on from that. Okay, there's one a little tiny point I just wanted to say. Here he is practicing at AHG, and it's just going so great. This is real practice. And so someone says to him, he did not allow me to stay at AHG so long time. 1 year is enough. You will become stinky AHG student. That's enough. You should go to Sojiji. All right, that's what he said. He told that story a few times. That's not quite that. The way, the one I used in the book, but extremely close. I did use, I don't want you to become a stinky AHG student. Interesting, huh? It takes him out of there after 1 year. Now, Suzuki's son, Hoitsu, and his grandson were both there 3 years. And then Hoitsu went back and got very high positions there. He was right. Listen, Hoitsu is in line to be an abbot of AHG. He was, this was said to me by the person I would consider an American who's the most knowledgeable American about Soto Zen in terms of Japanese Zen. I was talking about him with Peter Schneider. I think his name's Daigaku Rume, who spent many years in Japan at Hoshinji with Seki Harada. One of the great Zen masters in Japan who's taught a lot of Westerners. And I think Harada's gone to Italy some too. And Hoshinji is in Obama. I've been there. I know him. He was head of Soto Zen in America. He was the only foreigner. He was non-Japanese. He was the first. And this is Soto Zen under the Shumutsu, the Soto Zen organization in Japan, the official one connected with Japan, Japanese Soto Zen. Zenshuji is a temple associated with both AHG and Sojiji, and is the head temple of Soto Zen in North America in that order. I don't know what to call it. The San Francisco Zen Center and most other Soto Zen groups that I'm familiar with are independent and just have a cordial relationship with the Japanese Soto Zen, nothing official. Of course, it's very decentralized anyway. I mean, each individual temple has a great deal of autonomy, even in Japan. Different amounts, depending on how much support they get. But Kiba, who was bishop before Daigaku, and who I've mentioned before because he was one of the people that went over the Japanese translation of Crooked Cucumber and made corrections and this and that. So he was responsible, is my understanding, for getting Daigaku to take that position and getting the Shumucho to agree. To me, that was amazing. It was entirely Japanese Americans with Japanese priests until recent times. Before that, Daigaku had worked for the Soto Zen International Department or whatever it's called. And I remember him living at the city center and going to work at the new Sokoji. They moved out of that old building where we were years ago. And Daigaku is now in North Carolina, and the website for his group is greattreetemple.org. Yeah, I really respect him. But he told me, like, all right, Hoetsu was Godo. First, he was Tanto. Tanto is the Ino's head of the training in the Zento. The Ino is like the head disciplinarian and head of the Zento and all that. The Tanto's above the Ino is really head of training. But the Godo is above them, and that's just right below the habit. And that's what Daigon told me. He said he's right in line to be an abbot. My God, I can remember Hoetsu telling me, I hate Zazen, you know. Well, years and years ago, he changed. and you know, even in recent years, I don't know what he's doing now. He's been going like once a month over to Okayama to a Soto, a small monastery there, and leading sesshins. I mean, he's had tons and tons of very serious practice and teaching positions there, more than his father had. I mean, you know what people said about Shunyu Suzuki was that he didn't have any big positions in Japan. He wasn't really a Roshi who gave talks and lectures and stuff like that. And, you know, I'd hear, you know, they'd say, yeah, he was just a priest in a country temple, you know. What's he doing starting a group in America? But that his reputation has changed some since then. So how about it saying, you will become stinky Aheiji student? Now, I think that's the wrong word. And that, you know, I thought, oh, I saw it in what I read. I looked in the book. Yeah, it says Aheiji student. He would never have said Aheiji student. He would have said Aheiji monk. I can't think of any Japanese word he would use. He wouldn't have. Anyway, so why did Suzuki use that word? Because I looked, and I'm looking at verbatim transcripts. Because that's what we were. We were students. We weren't monks. There were, you know, little by little, there were a few people ordained. We didn't even use the word monk. We used priest. Bang, you are ordained, you're a priest. and which has its problems. And, but they would have said, he would have said, you will become stinky Aheiji monk. Now, I didn't change it in what I read. I don't have it marked down to change in the book because I just don't feel, I think that's what he meant to say. It's just not what he said. But I think that would be right. And at some point, I might feel I have enough authority to change it. You know, it's just editing what Suzuki said. He didn't want his, I've made all his lectures available online at juniorsuzuki.com, just verbatim, you know, for any edited version, any of them, they're all there. They're all linked to or whatever. But he never wanted his lectures made available unedited. They were always edited to be put in the windmill or if they're made available in any way. But at a certain point, you know, he lost his vote. And Zen Center lost, you know, the people who felt that in Zen Center lost their vote. And, you know, it's one of these things about, you know, how much should a religious organization and senior priests and blah, blah, control what the rest of us can see? So I didn't believe in that. And Ed Brown and I talk about that in our little chat that's coming up in a few days. All right. Did you hear that little birdie? It sort of depends on what sort of speakers or earplugs or earphones you're listening on. But every once in a while, there's the little bird in the background going, ah. That's higher than that. An octave above that or two. Very faint, but it's there. So then after Sohn tells Suzuki, he didn't want him being a stinky Aeiji monk. And then he did the same thing to him at Sojiji. He was just half a year at Sojiji. He goes, and he says, oh, this is great. This is perfect. You know, I could just ride this out forever. And I know that feeling, man. I tell you, living at Tassara, I just thought, I could keep doing this forever. And Sessions, too. You know, toward the end of the day, I just thought, I could just keep sitting Sessions forever. I mean, it's painful and difficult, but feels good. I could just keep doing it. But you can't keep doing it. And you know, great masters have told you, don't keep doing it. Suzuki, for one, some people wanted to sit forever, right? They wanted to sit all the time. Their idea was, the more I sit, the better. Because he did emphasize Zazen a great, great deal. I mean, it was his answer to many, many questions all the time. But he didn't want us depending on Zazen. And Richard Baker once in a lecture at Gringo said, all the Buddhas laugh at someone who depends on Zazen. I thought that was good. Suzuki said, Sessions, you know, one or two times a year. And what he wanted people to get into was daily practice, minute-to-minute practice, you know, sit once or twice a day. And I know people who have been in Theravada monasteries and done three-month practice periods. And the monks there say, a week? That didn't even count. You can't get anywhere in a week. You have to have, like, months of it, just straight. And, you know, that might be true, but I never did that. I know a number of people who have, and some of them ended up being Zen teachers. Some of them remained loyal to Theravadin, but none of them I know have stayed doing that. They might say that's the only, and what they tend to do then is not sit daily and say the only thing that counts is sitting 3 months at a time. I'm more into, there's this wonderful Tibetan teacher in Richmond, Point Richmond, right over the Richmond Bridge from Marin County. I can't remember his name, I'll stick it in. Anam Thubten, dharmada.org. And he gave a talk. Oh, I loved going to his Sunday talks. I just thought he was wonderful. And very popular Sunday talks in this beautiful old Redwood Church. And I love Point Richmond. It's a cool little tiny place. And I have a very good friends there, a couple. Bill Schwab and Reiko. And Bill did, Bill knows the Suzukis, and you know, I knew Rego when I was living in Kyoto, and later he got together with her and they got married. They've been together many, many years and they're great artists, and he's a great sculptor, photographer. And they've been to Rinso Inn. And Bill's black and white photos of Rinso Inn were on display at the San Francisco Zen Center, City Center, years ago. And he donated them, and he framed them and matted them and everything. Very nice gift. They're all on shunyasuzuki.com. And not just Rinso Inn, but also Zon Inn and Shoganji, all three temples Shunya Suzuki lived at in Japan. Thank you, Bill Schwab. But that's not why I'm mentioning Point Richmond. It's that the great Tibetan teacher there, he gave this talk. He talked about Mind the Gap. If you're in London, they have this whole thing about the subways, whatever they call them, and the trains. Mind the Gap. When you're going in, there's a little space between where you are and where you step into it. And he talked about, meditating in the gaps. A minute if you can do it, just seconds if you can do it, just always feel, any hole you get to, just meditate through it. And I think you can do that. I do it. I've done it a long time. So Suzuki goes back to the monastery after he's been, he goes back to Aeji after he's been for some period at Rinso Inn and Zon Inn, but knowing he just got to ride out the last 2 months in the summer, and that's it. And he talks about, how he cried, and the way he said he cried coming in, walking into the steps or just coming up and seeing it. And I've talked to other people who've gone back to their old temples, and that happened to him, just break down sobbing. He said, the tears were coming from my mouth, nose, and eyes. That's something that Japanese say. That's an old thing they say, I believe. That's how I remember it. That's great. Really gives a feeling of, really crying. But then he says, really when we're practicing there, and I loved it when he said that, to us, it's nothing special. It's just, that's normal, usual life. When somebody comes from the outside, we think, oh, there's some unusual people. Is it? I don't think the monks today would experience people who came in as unusual people as in Shunyu Suzuki's day back in the 30s, because there's a big hotel there for people who stay overnight. It's a major tourist destination. The hotel is more for people there on a sort of pilgrimage. Some people, it might be their only time to come to the great Aeji, and they'll be, their small temple that they go to at home will have been Soto Zen, and they've been looking forward to it. So people go there in great numbers to have a day or two of special lay practice. I've sat in a room with 100 or more of these guests listening to a lecture in Japanese that was way over my head. The 2 times I've been at Aeji, I didn't notice any negative impact from all of that. I'd heard about it. I'd heard about it from monks. But maybe there weren't a lot of people there when I was there. It still seemed rather peaceful and quiet and impressive as heck. Well, the tourists and the guests, they can't just go anywhere in the temple. And I guess where I was sealed off from them. But Katrinka and I took a walk in the woods. We were there a couple of nights, and the last morning we took a walk in the woods. There wasn't anybody. We didn't see anybody. We went up the road, way up the road. People stay usually you know, their cars or their bus, their tourist buses, outside the front gate, and the road that goes up the mountain isn't anything they'd be using. And as for it seeming normal when you're there, now that's true, of course, and that's true for us too at Tassajara and whatever you do. So that's one thing, but another thing is how moved someone can be returning to the place where one had an opportunity to practice in such a concentrated way with others for some extended period. Returning and in just remembering. I, of course, have experienced that, like at Tassajara, people will come, and he said, the people coming from the outside get this deep, wonderful, reverent feeling. But those of us who are there living there, we're just living our life. We're not, you know, not necessarily getting any of those deep, reverent feelings. So that's what you want. You want to be there, and that's really good, long enough to where it's just everyday life. But I will say that, you know, I've spent lots and lots of time talking to my old friends who've been at Tassajara and other people who have been there and people who studied with Suzuki and this and that. And in my life, I've not experienced directly anything that people look back on so fondly and gratefully as they do practicing at Zen Center. Really, and pulls people's heartstrings. And this is a very high percentage of people who were there. Okay, that wraps it up for comments on Chapter 4. I don't know how much of this I'll leave in. Good Lord. Okay. I left almost all of it in. The tangents and the tangents off tangents. My apologies. So, thanks for joining in. I'm DC, the Poobah of Cuke Archives and Cuke Audio, wishing you a grand awakening. ¶¶